Hi, you're listening to the Yale Anesthesiology Podcast. Make sure to visit our show website so that you can take advantage of the links of the papers that will be mentioned during this recording. Thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Antonio Gonzalez, and I'm thrilled to present our next guest. Dr. Teresa Vogel is an obstetric anesthesiologist interested in a topic we should all know about. We're talking about trauma-informed care today. Her interest in birth trauma and training as a sexual assault counselor provided her the tools to become the director of the Allegheny Health Network's Perinatal Trauma-Informed Care Clinic, one of the first in the nation. A service that offers comprehensive trauma-informed care for all birthing persons with histories of previous trauma. Their services include shared decision-making, birth planning, multidisciplinary collaboration and communication, while also building patient trust and advocating for optimal outcomes for mothers and babies. Dr. Vogel has been a guest speaker at many national and international meetings. Besides, she is very active in our Society for Obstetric Anesthesia and Perinatology and leads a special interest group on maternal mental health and birth trauma. Welcome to our podcast, Dr. Vogel. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Hi, Antonio. It's an absolute privilege. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So I guess the biggest question right now is, what is trauma-informed care?
Well, if you think about trauma-informed care in a general sense, we're talking about shifting the way we approach patients from more of a patriarchal approach and saying, this is what we're going to do to you today, to more of a collaborative approach where we're thinking about how can we work together with you to achieve some mutually agreeable care plan that also takes into account your historical context. So more defined definitions to really talk about trauma-informed care involving awareness of the pervasive nature of trauma. So realization, that's the first R. Recognition, so identifying what it looks like in individuals and ourselves. Responding, changing our policies and protocols to reflect what we know so we mitigate the effects of trauma, and preventing new traumas from occurring and re-traumatization. So it's really four R's: realize, recognize, respond, and resist re-traumatization. The CDC, as well as the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, I'll call SAMHSA because that's a mouthful, they've expanded on those four R principles to create six pillars of trauma-informed care practices. And these include the establishment of safety, which is very, very important for trauma survivors, trustworthiness, peer support, collaboration, empowerment, so giving patients voice and choice in what they do, and then cultural and historical context, so understanding them from where they come. So that's really what we're talking about when we say trauma-informed care.
Yeah, it's a very important concept, and I think that definitely we should all strive to practice in a trauma-informed care manner. I think as we get deeper into the podcast, it's going to become very clear that really patients want to be heard. And if we do that, for the most part, we can actually provide better care to them. And now the other question that I have is that as anesthesiologists, we need to be cognizant that some of our interactions or what the patients experience during labor or a C-section may be traumatic, yet most of this traumatic experience may be revealed postpartum and not immediately during or after labor. It is my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that as anesthesiologists, we have little exposure to traumatic events or when the patients tell us, oh, that was very traumatic. This happens rarely. So what prompted you to be a patient advocate, particularly in trauma-informed care?
Well, Antonio, this is not where I envisioned I would be in my career. I didn't start off this way, but when I thought back on my past, I've always been interested in patient perspectives. Even as a fellow in OB anesthesia, that was some of my research back then in the late 90s and early 2000s. I think what really made me pivot in terms of how I approached patients, how I got on this path, was the fact that I was able to work exclusively in obstetric anesthesia with my current job. And being there every day allowed me to see things with a slightly different lens and to be more conscious of what people were telling me about prior events, being a little more curious, putting it all together, so to speak. So I think for me, it was being able to follow up. And then, like you said, we don't always get to see what the consequences are of a traumatic birth. We're not getting the feedback. Well, I was able to elicit some of that feedback from patients and then be able to take it back into our space and say, whoa, there are some things that we're doing that are traumatizing individuals. I didn't realize it at the time that what I was trying to promote was trauma-informed care. I didn't understand it myself until I trained as a sexual assault counselor as well and had a little more context of what trauma is. But that's how I started out.
And I think that that is great. It seems like you definitely seem to have found your purpose, and that is amazing. Now, one thing that I want to highlight is in one of your articles, you refer to a publication that it's from the 1950s. And I thought that just making reference to of that publication was very, it created a lot of impact when I was reading it. Why don't you please talk to us about that publication? And maybe then I will share my experience when I was reading about it.
Well, first of all, I would highly recommend it to anybody that wants to read it. And you can give us your comments too, but I found it fascinating. It did come out in 1957 or 58, I believe, in the Ladies' Home Journal. And what they did is they published this, what they called the sources of suffering for women in childbirth. And they documented things that are not unlike what we're hearing about today with more modern birth trauma narratives from some of our sports celebrities, like Serena Williams, for example, Allyson Felix. They are talking about the exact same sources of suffering, even though that they are separated by decades, these narratives. It's the same things. And these sources of suffering that hundreds of women wrote in to talk about included loss of autonomy, feelings of powerlessness, use of restraints, pain, negative interactions with caregivers, especially in the sense that they felt that they were not treated as a human. It was inhumane treatment, and it's profound. These are separated by decades, and yet what we hear today is the same as what we hear in this article.
Yeah, that's what was really, really, you know, powerful to hear about these, because it's actually kind of sad to hear that we are not doing much better. And I think that definitely getting this information out there should make us strive to do better. Now, talking about how can we do better, you have not only created or being part the director of this health network clinic, but you also have a platform to communicate with patients and guide them throughout the process of trauma. Would you please talk us about the purpose of this website?
The purpose initially was for me to do something. That was the first thing I did when I felt like I needed to make change, but I didn't know what else to do at the time. And so I started this website, and what it was meant to do was to encourage collaboration and a sharing of information, but for both patients and providers. And I don't know if you realize this, Antonio, but if you look at the logo, there's actually, as part of it, is a bidirectional arrow. For any chemistry or science buffs out there, they might recognize that that arrow symbolizes an equilibrium in an equation. What I meant by it is that there has to be a balance, and both patients and providers need to be empowered with the knowledge and the skills to address trauma, especially when it intersects with childbirth, which is a very vulnerable situation. I incorporate narratives from patients with my own commentary in there. I include references for providers. The whole purpose is to promote collaborative approaches and hopefully encourage more positive birth experiences by seeing someone else's perspective.
Yeah, I think the website was great. And the name of the website is called The Empowerment Equation, correct?
Correct.
So some of the resources were great. There were YouTube videos or links to YouTube videos. I will definitely recommend the audience to watch those YouTube videos and see for yourself how we treat the patients and how we should treat the patients. It's very impactful, the video. So it was very nicely done. Thank you for taking the time to share that video with us. In some of your shared stories, you have described recommended using small doses of anxiolytics. At times, we are overly concerned about the effects these sedatives may have. Would you please talk about the evidence and benefits of utilizing anxiolytics, particularly in these patients with previous trauma?
It's interesting. I'm actually a minimalist, but if you look at my record in the last couple of years, I think I've recommended the use of anxiolytics more than I have in my entire career. I think it's really important that we take a moment and think about what we're trying to accomplish with anxiolytics. You have to balance, and this is where I think the fear comes in, when we fear the effect that it's going to have on the neonate and maybe a little bit on the fetus. However, when we're talking about giving these medications to someone at term, for example, in labor and delivery, in a C-section, teratogenicity doesn't really play into it, although there is some controversy about these medications, could they contribute possibly to ongoing neurobehavioral development? There is still controversy there, but overall, teratogenicity is not an issue with small doses. So we're balancing, again, the fear of what am I doing to the neonate if I give these medications? Also, we're concerned about if we give medications, are we going to over-sedate the mother and take away her memory and or cause sedation enough to perhaps cause her to have respiratory impairment, let's say something like that. That has to be balanced against what are the effects or what's the impact of withholding that treatment for someone who is then going to experience severe anxiety or panic. And there are physical as well as psychological consequences of withholding that medication. So when we talk about effects on the neonate, there are numerous studies that are out there showing the safety profile of using low doses of these medications for individuals that have preeclampsia and are getting general anesthetics. And they looked at everything from Apgar scores to neurobehavioral scores to blood gases and really showed no difference between this group and controls. So there are profiles that are safe for things like dexmedetomidine and low-dose midazolam for the neonate. And honestly, when I am in practice using these medications, I use doses that are much less than those that were even studied with great effect. Now, when we talk about the potential negative impact on the birthing person who has a history of trauma or history of anxiety, and we withhold medications, we need to think about the physiologic effects, such as the increase in heart rate, increase in blood pressure, increase in respiratory rate, potential decrease in uterine blood flow, severe shaking. All of that can potentially cause a negative impact on the baby's health, not only the mother's health, but the psychological impact is huge. Terror can lead to a negative subjective view of the birth experience. Dissociation can happen for individuals where they're not even with you. They don't remember the birth then and have to go on to grieve the loss of the experience. So what you're trying to avoid with your medications, you're still going to get if they have dissociation. And that can lead to an increased risk for postpartum PTSD. So really what you need to think about is a balance here. You don't need high doses of medications to help minimize anxiety, minimize the potential for panic. And these medications can be used with a lot of other non-pharmacologic means to help minimize stress as well. So again, it's all about the balancing act, but I don't think that providers should be withholding medication only because they fear that it's going to have a negative impact on the neonate.
Yeah, I think that is actually very interesting. And it goes back to the whole process of what we discussed before. This is the shared decision making, right? And I was thinking about maybe asking this question a little later on the podcast, but you know, it ties very nicely with these. And is that in a recent study by Sanchez and colleagues publishing the Anesthesia and Critical Care and Pain Medicine 2023, besides describing their institutional incidence of intraoperative pain, they also describe something interesting that goes along with what we just discussed. That is that at times, the anesthesiologist will give medications to the patient without the patient really asking for medication, or maybe it's unclear whether communication happened, you know, the patient wanted the medication. And then it's not unusual for patients to say, you know, I kind of, like you mentioned before, I missed that experience. So you know, it seems like you've heard similar stories and how we should go around or how we should go about this.
Well, I think you already said it, is that the key here is communication, right? We tend to give some of these agents for other things. Dexmedetomidine can be used for shaking. Propofol can be used for nausea. Benadryl can be used for nausea as well as a calming effect. Doses of Benadryl, even when we think of them as being low, 25 milligrams intravenously, is still enough to take away someone's memory for individuals, especially parturients at term. So we need to, first of all, rethink doses. If we're going to use these agents for other things, and it might be appropriate for these other things, use the absolute lowest dose possible and titrate to effect if needed. But I think the key here is to think about what does the patient want out of this. Let me give you an example in terms of treating nausea. There might be an individual who tells me, Dr. Vogel, nausea and vomiting are a trigger for my previous trauma. I absolutely cannot be nauseated. And we have a conversation about, well, certain medicines we might need to use may impair your memory. How do you feel about that? And they might say to me, I don't care. Knock me out. I can't be nauseated. So there's your answer. They're okay with that if it means they're not going to be sick. Others might say, look, I can handle a little bit of nausea, but I need to remember the birth of this child. In which case, you support them as best you can. You put a cold cloth on their forehead and you hold the bucket. And they know you're there with them, but they're willing to accept that. It's when we are making the decisions for them that I think we start to see more of this traumatic nature start to come into play.
That is phenomenal. And I think it's about creating and talking about the labor experience for the patient and trying to give that to the patient, give them that labor experience. So definitely we should be talking about statistics, right? We cannot talk about trauma, we cannot talk about these without really knowing what are the statistics till this day.
We talk about birth trauma, like those individuals that consider their births as traumatic experiences. The studies suggest that up to 44% of women, depending on the population, will report their births as traumatic. Now, I think of that number as being very high, especially when you think of what's out there in the lay public, the social media. They paint this picture that all is joyous in the land of obstetrics, but 44% would tell you it is not. Now, when we think about PTSD, so giving them a diagnosis of an ongoing illness after a traumatic birth, we're looking at numbers roughly between maybe 6 and 9% of all postpartum individuals would meet criteria for postpartum PTSD. That includes even those individuals who have PTSD prior to childbirth. So sometimes it's hard to tease out. Is it the childbirth itself that's causing the PTSD symptoms? Is it pre-existing PTSD that then is exacerbated by a traumatic birth? And then we see that surface, but we see about 5 to 6, up to 9%. Now, according to research by Sharon Deek, a lot of Harvard, she is one of our leading experts in this field. They also found that women who don't have pre-existing PTSD can exhibit postpartum PTSD with rates of about 4.6%. So childbirth events themselves are known to cause childbirth-related postpartum PTSD.
Yeah, those numbers are quite impressive. And I'm guessing that's what really has driven and open up the opportunity for you to become the director of this Allegheny Health Network Perinatal Trauma. Talk us a little bit about that experience and congratulations on this first in the nation type of clinic.
Thank you. There is one other one that I know of, and I have already connected with the person who runs it in Oregon, an obstetrician, and she does her similarly, but there's some subtle differences. But this was a decade worth of work to establish this clinic. And I had to reach out and get a grant to help establish the infrastructure for it. But my clinic lives in our women's behavioral health unit. And my work is collaborative across all disciplines, the mother-baby unit, anesthesiology, as well as women's behavioral health. What I do is I visit with individuals that come to me, and they can be referred through any of our obstetric teams, NICU teams, nurses, even anesthesiologists have referred patients that they feel could use some additional support. They meet with me either in pregnancy because they've had a history of some sort of trauma, including birth trauma or fear of childbirth. They can meet with me postpartum after an acutely traumatic event. And some people meet with me not quite pregnant yet, but who've had trauma, birth trauma, and they don't even know if they should get pregnant again. Could it be different? So I have three different populations of patients, but I see them for the first time for an hour, then I might have two or three more visits throughout the pregnancy, and we prepare. We identify triggers, identify fears, work on a plan that minimizes or eliminates those or gives them the skills to manage them when the time comes. And then these strategies are communicated to all of the teams for implementation.
That is great. But at the same time, it seems like we've only two trauma-informed care clinics in the nation. So how do you see patients virtually? So let's say if I have a patient that I think may benefit from seeing you in this clinic, can they have a virtual clinic meeting? Is that a possibility, or is it only to Pennsylvania area?
The clinic itself is structured to be within Pennsylvania. If we're using insurance for payments, by law, they have to be within the state of Pennsylvania. Now, I do most of my visits virtually. I do see patients in person if they prefer, if they're local. So you bring up a good question. If someone was paying out of pocket or not using insurance, I believe I could still see them through my clinic. But I also allow my website platform for patients to reach out through there, and I have separate Zoom conversations with them. At this point, haven't established a set billing plan, and I'm a little concerned because it's getting busier now, and it's only me at the moment, but building a team is on my agenda.
Yeah, that is great. And so another point that kind of ties to this is that, you know, I think that the government has started taking a lot more initiative, particularly because it has become very clear that the maternal mental health has become the number one cause of maternal death in the United States. Unfortunately, although there are several websites, like Connecticut has one, the Access Mental Health Connecticut.com webpage offers a hotline for moms that are having depression and things like that. It's actually very hard to know about these resources. For example, I wouldn't know anything about this if not because I'm actually doing this podcast and I've gotten in contact with Dr. Miriam Audrey, who's part of the committees that it's in the knows about this website. So do you agree that there are resources, yet their existence is not promoted, or there are better ways to promote these resources.
I totally agree. There are resources and they are growing, but people don't know about them, right? Why are we not talking about this more? And I think some of this stems from the fact that we still don't prioritize mental health as part of health. When you think about safety bundles, safety, patient safety, it's all about physical safety right now. We really haven't done much to construct safety bundles or plans about psychological safety. Right? And that's a little bit different. But once we start to do that and recognize psychological safety as being equally as important as physical safety, then I think we might see more of these start to come out and be more available to patients, and you know, resource sheets will be everywhere for everyone to access. But I do think organizations like SOAP, ACOG, some of these programs like collaboratives throughout the states, PQCs, the perinatal collaboratives, MMRCs might be useful in promoting some of this as well. But I think we could leverage a lot of those organizations to help spread the word.
Yeah, and one question that I've had for a while, particularly after I had this amazing podcast with Susanna Stanford, who is a patient that experienced intraoperative pain, I have this question, and it's like, when do you start screening for trauma? One thing that she brought up is like, you cannot assume that every patient, although you think what she went through was traumatic, will actually develop trauma, which makes it very hard to kind of, you know, how do we screen for trauma without really planting that seed in there that what the event was traumatic? What is your approach?
Well, screening tools, that's the million-dollar question right now, Antonio. Everyone wants the best screening tool. What do we use? When do we ask the questions? I think Susanna's right in the sense that just because you see someone had a, let's say, a massive hemorrhage and or goes to the ICU, you think that's traumatic. That's a huge complication. It may not be. That person may have felt supported, be well connected, was not fearful, trusted her teams. She might have a lot of mitigating factors against trauma and she does fine. There could be someone who has no physical complications and you say, oh, well, she's healthy baby, healthy mom, all is good. She might be the one to develop trauma. So I think, first of all, we need to make sure everyone is clear on that. The complications do not equate to trauma. And trauma does not always stem from what you see as, you know, objective complications. I think we need some universal ways to ask open-ended questions in the postpartum period. I think resources need to be available to all patients at discharge, no matter how they feel. Because I think asking a question too soon, they might not even realize what's happening to them. They might still be in shock from what happened. Maybe just planting the seed that there is help here. You may start to experience symptoms, you may not, but we want you to reach out. Obstetricians should be asking some questions at the 2-week, 6-week follow-ups. When we talk about screening when they're pregnant, and that's different. So we're talking about afterwards. I think it has to be multiple time points and it has to be different kinds of questions, right? Just to give them a checkbox that says, did you feel like you were going to die at any point? Did you feel your child was at risk for harm or going to die at any point? Sure, you can ask those questions. I've had plenty of people tell me no to those questions, but meet every criteria for PTSD in terms of symptomatology. But when I ask them, did you feel that you felt powerless, loss of autonomy, loss of control? They say, absolutely. So the questions themselves have to be just right. The timing has to be right. But I also think that allowing someone to have a safe space to tell their narrative is important. And that's where my clinic work comes in, because we have that place. Individuals can come when they're ready and talk to me and tell their narrative in a space without judgment, and talk through it and get some closure, et cetera. Now, let's go back to when do we screen ahead of time for trauma? And my response to that is that has to be done as early as possible in pregnancy. because then it allows for time to address fears, concerns, possible triggers, plan, let everyone know what's going on. And I think the earlier we can intervene, the better chance we have of minimizing stress in pregnancy and getting better outcomes.
That is actually very interesting. And now that you mentioned that, it comes to mind that the OBSQR 10 or the obstetric questionnaires, 10 questions has been validated. Purvis Sultan has done some amazing work around this area, in this field, regarding these prompts or patient-related outcome measurements. One of the questions is actually, I feel I'm in control. Now the question again comes, so when do you ask the patients to fill this questionnaire? 24 hours later, 48 hours later? And you know, maybe we can start looking into knowing what that trigger number is going to be. Is it going to be 5? Is it going to be 7? That needs some research, but it's a very interesting point that I haven't thought about before. So thank you for bringing that up. I think that was great. Now, the other thing that you mentioned, and actually you mentioned the example of a patient that experiences postpartum hemorrhage. One thing that seems to be counterintuitive is that the California Maternal Quality Care Collaborative created all these national safety bundles for hypertension, postpartum hemorrhage. And now you described that at times having these teams that respond to emergencies may actually trigger trauma instead of the opposite of what you mentioned is like, well, I felt supported because there was so many people that I knew that I was being taken care of. So it probably can go anywhere, right? Again, this is the complicated side of trauma.
Complicated is a good word. If anybody who's listening has ever been involved with what we call condition O, condition obstetrics, you may have a different name for it, but rapid response or emergency response to crises in obstetrics, you know that there are so many people that come running into the room. Everyone's doing their own thing. A lot of times, no one is assigned for the psychological health and well-being of the patient. It's not part of the bundle, or actually it's starting to become more of a part of these bundles. We need to think about that. In these emergency responses, it is overwhelming to most people to have 20 people come running into a room. A lot of them don't know why they're there. A lot of people don't understand because no one's telling them what is happening. No one is speaking to the patient in a calm voice, holding their hand with a spouse or significant other standing right there at the head of the bed and explaining what is happening in a calm voice. And I think that is where the terror comes in and that significant fear that they don't understand what's happening. Plus, there's that intrinsic concern about, like, what is actually happening? If they are having an acute event in labor, there is the fear that something's going to happen to their child, right? So that meets the definition of trauma based on the DSM-5. So that response can be overwhelming and terrifying to individuals. Another response that's part of these protocols is for hemorrhage, where manual extraction of clots is a typical process that happens with the obstetricians. It's part of their thought process. I must remove the clots to stop the bleeding. Now, just step back for a minute. A woman has just delivered a baby vaginally. And if they have a history of trauma, especially sexual trauma, these obstetricians are coming in as part of their protocol, must manually extract clots. And sometimes they do this without consideration for patient's history, patient saying, no, don't do that, and refusal, and the level of pain relief that the patient has at the time. So you have excruciating pain, no control, re-traumatization from prior trauma. It's easy to see how that could be an event. Even though you're there to save them from the physical element of hemorrhage, you're causing a psychological trauma instead, or at the same time.
Yeah, very interesting concept. So I think that it seems like a good idea to me that every patient that has a rapid response, or however we call this, definitely should be screened very closely for the development of trauma. Now, I have this, I definitely don't want to finish the podcast without bringing up this quote, which I think it's brilliant. And the quote is, a service that is not trauma-informed is trauma-denied. Would you please expand on this concept?
Well, I thought it was brilliant too. When I read that article, and I had to include that in some of my writings, it was something that stood out to me as well. Because when we think about trauma informed care and trauma awareness, it's a cultural change is what we're trying to make. And in order to get there, we need to think about this on a cultural level, a big scale. And when they say a system that is not trauma informed is trauma denied, it means if we do not teach our providers and our systems about the impact of violence, adversity, and trauma in an individual's life, we're basically denying the existence of all of that in their life and on the rest of their life and development and behaviors going forward. It really told me that we need to not only see patients in the present, but we have to see their past and how it plays into the present as well. But yeah, I thought it was genius. We all need to be trauma-informed. I have no doubts. Like everybody at every level of every organization needs some level of awareness and training so that we can take better care of our patients.
So I guess the next question is, how do we become a trauma-informed care unit?
Education is one, right? I think that's really, really important. And we need to get buy-in from a lot of the administrators and leadership in hospitals because it's not cheap. Providers need to do the training. And it's not really a, let's do a little module on the computer and check the box. Again, this is a cultural change. We're asking people to really share control with their patients, share decision-making, collaborative care. We're not trained for that. It's something that takes time and practice, but it starts with prioritization. Right? This is important. Trauma is pervasive. It's everywhere. We need to dig in and we need to start training people. That's number one. Then it has to be a slow, like baby steps. Start with things you can change. Implement new policies. Right? The third R is respond by taking what we know and change it so that you're not doing this for one individual at a time. You're changing the policy so that it's there and it becomes second nature. That's a big one. And then really actively figuring out how can we resist re-traumatizing these folks over time.
And in your website, right? Mm-hmm. You do offer education, right? You do offer education to units?
I do, yes. I travel with our Pennsylvania PQC and I go to member hospitals within the state and offer full day trainings. I'm now going to other states to do that kind of work. I am available to all sorts of systems. I'm visiting, and I'm sure they wouldn't mind me saying, University of Washington is having me come back for a second round. They use their combined obstetric anesthesiology conference last year and had me come and do a full day training in trauma-informed care. And they found it incredibly valuable. So they want me to come back and do a second session. So it can be done in a variety of ways, but yeah, I do offer training, but I'm not the only one that can do basic lectures. That postpartum.net offers some great education as well. I'm sure that wherever people are in their states, there is some great education on trauma in general. But if you want more of an immersive type of education, I don't know of others that are doing full day types of training, especially in obstetrics and especially for anesthesia providers.
Yeah, no, that is great. So I think that offering that education throughout your website, the empowerment equation, it's phenomenal. Now, I have one last question, and this question I think can be a little tricky. I wouldn't like people to misinterpret this question because for me, taking care of labor pain it's what we do, right? So it's something that I really take at heart. Now, there is this basic knowledge that labor pain can be painful. And you know, obviously some patients have, you know, trauma related to their labor experience, and that could be related to an epidural that didn't work perfectly well, and they experienced more discomfort that they wanted to or they could tolerate, and they develop some trauma about it. Now, the question here is, like, knowing that this, you know, laboring is painful, how can this turn out to be a traumatic experience? Is there a problem with, like, the communication? Maybe it's not necessarily that the epidural wasn't great, but that the patient was telling everybody, this epidural is not, it's not working well. I don't feel comfortable. And nobody seems to listen to the patient, or they feel like maybe the information was not relayed to the people that could have done something about that. And, you know, that is one of the reasons why we now have, like, Q2 hours checks on our patients, or Q4 hours, to make sure that we're constantly checking on our patients ourselves and not depend on a middle person coming in and tell us about how the patient is doing throughout their course. So what are your thoughts about this?
First of all, I love that you're doing every 2 hour checks, because for those individuals who feel that they don't want to feel pain, and they've communicated that, and they tell you, with my epidural, I don't want to feel anything other than some pressure, then I feel like it's good to give good customer service. That's what we should be striving for. Now, back it up a little bit to communication again. Not everybody wants to have all of their pain taken away. I'm going to give you a couple of examples. Some patients who know, for example, they're having a child with life-limiting diagnosis. So what does that mean? I mean, their child might live for 10 minutes, might live for a few hours. They don't know. So I work with a lot of these individuals, and we want to understand, what is it they want out of that birth experience? Right? Some patients will tell me, I would like to go through this with my child. I need to feel something. But they don't want to be in excruciating pain where they can't even focus on the birth itself. So working with our providers to make sure that we're not delivering high concentrations of local anesthetics, we check with them, we make sure she is feeling some pressure, some pain. They want that because that's important for what they're going through. On the other hand, individuals with prior sexual trauma, for example, really cannot feel anything. Even with counseling and working all through pregnancy, the only way to even attempt a vaginal birth is to not feel anything. And that's really important for us as anesthesia providers to do everything we can to work towards that goal. Otherwise, if they feel pain, we might not even succeed in getting a vaginal birth because they cannot relax those parts of the body because of triggering. So communication, number one, find out what the patient wants is key here. And remember, pain in and of itself, and I think this plays out in a lot of research now, it's controversial. Pain does not equate to trauma. And I think the reason we're seeing that is because some people can manage the pain. They feel supported through that pain. It's what they want. And that pain, just like with an athletic sporting event, it comes with what you're doing. You accept it. You know that that pain is going to equate to something good at the end, and you're willing to go with that, right? So some people need that. So keeping that in mind, that maybe talking to the patients, but even in those moments, though, where maybe we can't achieve the perfect balance, support that patient afterwards and validate that this might not have been what they were looking for and you wish it had gone differently. But if you were there and tried, and you were there every 2 hours, they know that you tried to make that work and support them and did whatever you could. And that mitigates further harm.
Yeah, I think that is actually key. And again, communication seems to be a big role, a big factor here. And, you know, certainly the way we say things, right, can have its own iatrogenic potential in terms of how the patient feels, right? Would you talk us about these a little bit?
Too bad you can't see my facial expressions through your podcast. But yes, absolutely, how we say things. Our language really it really does create a level of trauma in a lot of what we do, and we don't even realize it in what we say. A quick example in terms of leading to a lot of harm in the operating room is when we say to patients, do you feel pressure or pain here? And those two are not necessarily separate. You can have pressure that is painful. And I think those kinds of words are not really effective in what we're trying to assess. And I think more open-ended questions and asking about the degree of suffering in some way is better than asking about that. But other words in our vernacular, things like failure, is something that comes up a lot in my clinic. We even have words that we say all the time, failure to progress, failure to descend is part of our language, poor maternal effort. Keep in mind also that patients are now reading their medical record, so, and they hear us speak. So when we write stuff like that, they can read it. And for survivors of trauma, they already have lowered sense of self-efficacy, a lot of them. Some have a lowered sense of self-worth, especially if their trauma started in childhood. They already feel like failures. And we just add that layer of trauma onto it. For those that have been in labor a long time, maybe pushed for 6 hours and then come into our operating room to be told or to overhear someone say, well, it was poor maternal effort or failure to progress, they internalize that to think they themselves are a failure. Right? So that our language can be perceived very differently. Just another example that I like to use in my teaching is when we say that difficult patient, Antonio, in room two, difficult. What does that mean? Usually means I don't understand them and they're the problem, right? If we write these things or start saying them, we start to think about patients that way. And then that's how we interact with patients, is how we write about them, then how we think about them, then how we interact with them. Non-compliant is another great term that comes up a lot. What does that mean? It means, well, they didn't do what I told them to do. Instead of they were not able to follow said recommendations because, and then list maybe what are some of their hardships that they couldn't follow these recommendations. See, saying they're non-compliant is one-sided. But I mean, we could do an entire hour on just language and words, but those are examples of some of the ways that we stigmatize patients. We dismiss them. We don't listen to them. We triage how they're supposed to feel. You should be grateful. We saved your life yesterday. You should be happy. You had a healthy baby. You know, certainly people are happy they have a healthy baby. That doesn't mean they weren't traumatized in the process.
I agree 100%. And I think, we have to start paying more attention to our choice of words when describing our day-to-day interactions with patients. So I agree 100%. This has been an amazing podcast so far. Now I would like to culminate the podcast with Dr. Vogel's top 5 recommendations for creating a trauma-informed care labor and delivery unit.
So in the theme of the 4 R's, and then I'll add my 5th, I thought we'd use those to kind of put out there what I think is important. So the first R, which usually is realize, it is for all of us to try to get some understanding and education about how pervasive different types of trauma are in our environments, also in the lives of the patients. But even as important or more importantly is to understand ourselves. And if we ourselves have gone through trauma, what does that look like? And realize that we're a traumatized bunch as medical professionals right now, especially after COVID. R2, recognize. This means we have to take a moment to recognize when we're having an acute stress response after something very scary has just happened. Recognize what it looks like in our patients. And how about our colleagues? We cannot hope to help and support others through their traumatic moments if we ourselves are triggered and have unhealthy stress responses. The signs and symptoms of chronic toxic stress are everywhere. And once you start to recognize them, you can never unsee them. R3 is responding. Right? So awareness is a wonderful place to start, but has to be accompanied with advocacy and action. Change protocols where you can in your institutions and policies to reflect that a survivor needs trust, control, autonomy, and respect. R4 is the resist re-traumatization. Learn ways to resist trauma, prevent trauma, resist re-traumatizing others and each other as colleagues. Right? Try to see things from another perspective. And number 5 is allow yourself some grace. It's taken me a decade to get here. It takes time to change a culture. Grace and self-compassion start small. Sharing control isn't easy, but I'm confident that we can do it and we will make change.
Absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much. That was an amazing 5 recommendations. And truly, I mean, I'm really grateful that we have an anesthesiologist working on this great concept of trauma-informed care, teaching us about how to become a trauma-informed care unit. Thank you so much for your time and your expertise on this field. I'm really grateful, really, to have you as a colleague who's working on this amazing project of trauma-informed care. Thank you.
Thank you, Antonio. It's been an absolute pleasure.